Hi again. This is Mrs. English, and today I will be reading from Richmond Lattimore's translation of Homer's Iliad, and I will be reading Book 14. Book 14 of Homer's Iliad. This book begins, it continues the stalemate that Book 13 ended with. We ended with a stalemate in the previous book. And in this book, Poseidon will be helping the Greeks. Zeus is even further distracted by Hera. And Nestor is meeting with the wounded heroes. Remember, way back in Book 11, Nestor was helping the heroes, the three heroes that were wounded, Agamemnon, Diomedes, and Odysseus, were all wounded in Book 11. And in 11, Line 631, we even have the description of the beautiful cup, the Nestor cup, and we're picking up right from that point now. We're going back in time, and this scene is picking up right after Book 11, Line 623 to 42. It's right where they left off. Now, Nestor failed not to hear their outcry, though he was drinking his wine, but spoke in winged words to the son of Asclepius. Take thought how these things shall be done, brilliant Machaon. Remember that Machaon is the Greek surgeon. Beside the ships the cry of the strong young men grows greater. Now do you sit here and go on drinking the bright wine, until Hecamede the lovely-haired makes ready a hot bath for you, warming it, and washes away the filth of the blood-stains, while I go out and make my way till I find some watch-point. So Nestor wants to see what's going on. So he spoke, and took up the wrought shield of his son, Thrasymedes, breaker of horses. It lay in the shelter, all shining in bronze. Thrasymedes carried the shield of his father. Then he caught up a powerful spear edged in sharp bronze, and stood outside the shelter, and at once saw a shameful action. Men driven to flight, and others harrying them in confusion. The great-hearted Trojans and the wall of the Achaeans overthrown. As, what was it like when Nestor went out and saw that the Trojans are winning, the walls coming down, the Achaeans are overthrown? As when the open sea is deeply stirred to the groundswell, but stays in one place, and waits the rapid onset of tearing gusts, nor rolls its surf onward in either direction until from Zeus the wind is driven down to decide it? So the aged man pondered, his mind caught between two courses, whether to go among the throng of fast-mounted Danaans, or in search of Atreus' son Agamemnon, shepherd of the people. And in the division of his heart, this way seemed best to him, to go after the son of Atreus, while the rest went on with the murderous battle, and the weariless bronze about their bodies was clashing as the men were stabbing with swords and half-headed and leaf-headed spears. Now there came toward Nestor the kings under God's hand, they who had been wounded by the bronze, and came back along the ships, Tydeus' son Diomedes, and Odysseus, and Atreus' son Agamemnon. For there were ships that had been hauled up far away from the fighting, line 30, along the beach of the gray sea. They had hauled up the first ones on the plain, and by the stones of these had built their defenses. For, wide as it was, the seashore was not big enough to make room for all the ships, and the people also were straitened, and therefore they had hauled them up in depth, and filled up the long edge of the whole sea-coast, all that the two capes compassed between them. These lords walked in a group, each leaning on his spear, to look at the clamorous battle, and for each the heart inside his body was sorrowful, and Nestor the aged man, who now met them, made still more cast down the spirit inside the Achaeans. Line 40. And now powerful Agamemnon spoke aloud and addressed him. Nestor, son of Neleus, great glory of the Achaeans, why have you left the fighting where men die and come back here? I am afraid huge Hector may accomplish that word against me that he spoke, threatening among the Trojans assembled that he would not make his way back from the ships toward Ilion until he had set the ships on fire and killed the men in them. So he spoke then. Now all these things are being accomplished. Oh, shame! For I think that all the other strong-grieved Achaeans are storing anger against me in their hearts. Line 50. As Achilles did, and no longer will fight for me by the grounded vessels. Then answered him in turn the Geranian horseman Nestor. All these things have been brought to fulfillment, nor in any other way could even Zeus who thunders on high accomplish it. For the wall has gone down in which we put our trust, that it would be a protection for our ships and us, and could not be broken, and our men beside the fast ships are fighting incessantly without end. Nor could you tell any more, though you looked hard, from which side the Achaeans are broken into confusion. So indiscriminately are they killed, and their crying goes skyward. Line 60. We then must take thought together how these things shall be done, if wit can do anything for us now. I think that we must not enter the fight. A man cannot fight on when he is wounded. Then in turn, the Lord of Agamemnon spoke to him. Nestor, since now they're fighting beside the grounded vessels, and the wall we built has done us no good, nor the ditch either, where the Danaans endured so much, and their hearts were hopeful it would be a protection to the ships in them, and could not be broken, then such is the way it must be pleasing to Zeus, who is too strong. Line 70. That the Achaeans must die here, forgotten and far from Argos. For I knew it when with full heart he defended the Danaans, and I know it now when he glorifies these peoples as if they were blessed gods, and has hobbled our warcraft and our hands' strength. Come then, do as I say, let us all be won over, let us take all those ships that are beached near the sea in the first line, and haul them down and row them out in the shining water, and moor them at anchor stones out in the deep water until the immortal night comes down. If the Trojans will give over fighting for night's sake, then we might haul down the rest of our vessels. There's no shame in running, even by night, from disaster. Line 80. Here we have, for the third time, Agamemnon suggesting that they go home. Very interesting. The man does better who runs from disaster than he who is caught by it. Then, looking darkly at him, spoke resourceful Odysseus. So this is Odysseus speaking to Agamemnon. Son of Atreus, what sort of word escaped your teeth, the barrier? Ruinous! I wish you directed some other unworthy army, and were not lord over us to whom Zeus has appointed the accomplishing of wars, from our youth even until our old age. We are dead, each of us. Are you really thus eager to abandon the wide-wayed city of the Trojans, over which we have taken so many sorrows? Do not say it, for fear some other Achaean might hear this word, which could never at all get past the lips of any man who understood inside his heart how to speak soundly, who was a sceptred king, and all the people obeyed him in numbers like those of the Argives, whose lord you are. Line 95. Now I utterly despise your heart for the thing you have spoken. You, who in the very closing of clamorous battle, tell us to haul our strong benched ships to the sea, so that even more glory may befall the Trojans, who beat us already, and headlong destruction swing our way? Since the Achaeans will not hold their battle as the ships are being hauled seaward, but will look about and let go the exultation of fighting. There, O leader of the people, your plan will be ruined. Then in turn, the lord of men Agamemnon answered him. And of course, Agamemnon never claimed to be a diplomat. Odysseus, you have hit me somewhere deep in my feelings with this hard word. But I am not telling the sons of the Achaeans, the Greeks, line 105, against their will to drag their benched ships down to the water. Now let someone speak who has better counsel than this was, young man or old, and what he says will be to my liking. Now among them spoke Diomedes of the great war cry. That man is here. We shall not look far for him if you are willing to listen, and not be each astonished in anger against me, because by birth I am the youngest among you. I also can boast that my generation is of an excellent father, Tydeus. And, of course, Diomedes' father, Tydeus, died in the expedition of seven against Thebes, his famous warrior, whom now the heaped earth covers over in Thebes. For there were three blameless sons who were born to Portheus, and their home was in Pleuron and headlong Calydon. Agrius was first, then Melas, and the third was Oeneus the horseman, the father of my father, and in valor beyond all others. But Oeneus stayed in the land, while my father was driven and settled in Argos. Such was the will of Zeus and other immortals. Line 120. He married one of the daughters of Adrestus, and established a house rich in substance, and plenty of wheat-grown acres were his, with many orchards of fruit trees circled about him, and many herds were his. He surpassed all other Achaeans with the spear. If all this is true, you must have heard of it. Line 125. Therefore you could not, saying that I was base and unwarlike by birth, dishonor any word that I speak if I speak well. Let us go back to the fighting, wounded as we are. We have to. Once there, we must hold ourselves out of the onfall, clear of missiles, so that none of us will add to the wound he has got already. But we shall be there to drive them on. since even before this they favored their anger and stood far off and will not fight for us. So he spoke, and they listened well to him and obeyed him and went on their way. And the Lord of men, Agamemnon, led them. And neither did the glorious shaker of the earth keep blind watch. Who is this? Poseidon, line 135. But came among them now in the likeness of an old man, and took hold of Agamemnon, Atreus' son, by the right hand. So this is Poseidon, once again in disguise. Took hold of Atreus' son Agamemnon by the right hand, and spoke to him and addressed him in winged words. Son of Atreus, I think that now their baleful heart in the breast of Achilles must be happy as he stares at the slaughter of the Achaeans and their defeat. There is no heart in him, not even a little. Even so, may the gods strike him down. Let him go to destruction. But with you, the blessed gods are not utterly angry. There will still be a time when the lords of Troy and their counselors shall send dust wide on the plain, and you yourself shall look on them as they take flight for their cry away from the ships and the shelters. So he spoke, and swept on over the plain with a huge cry, like the yell 9,000 men send up. So Poseidon really should be careful. He might alarm Zeus with this war cry, right? The cry of 9,000 men, or 10,000 in battle as they close in the hateful strife of the war god. Line 150. Such was the cry of the powerful earth-shaker let go from his lungs, and in the heart of every Achaean implanted great strength to carry the battle on and fight without flinching. Now, Hera, she of the golden throne, standing on Olympus's horn, looked out with her eyes and saw at once how Poseidon, who was her very brother and her lord's brother, was bustling about the battle where men win glory, and her heart was happy. Then she saw Zeus sitting along the loftiest summit of Ida in the springs, and in her eyes he was hateful. And now the lady, ox-eyed Hera, was divided in purpose as to how she could beguile the brain in Zeus of the Aegis, line 160. And to her mind this thing appeared to be the best counsel, to array herself in loveliness and go down to Ida, and perhaps he might be taken with desire to lie in love with her next her skin, and she might be able to drift an innocent, warm sleep across his eyelids and seal his crafty perceptions. So Hera is thinking to lull Zeus off to sleep. She's going to distract him. And then Hector will have no protector. Line 166. She went into her chamber, which her beloved son Hephaestus had built for her, and closed the leaves in the doorposts snugly with a secret door bar, and none other of the gods could open it. There, entering, she drew shut the leaves of the shining door. Then, first from her adorable body, washed away all stains with ambrosia, and next anointed herself with ambrosial sweet olive oil, which stood there in its fragrance beside her, and from which, stirred in the house of Zeus by the golden pavement, a fragrance was shaken for ever forth, on earth and in heaven. When with this she had anointed her delicate body, and combed her hair, and next with her hands she arranged the shining and lovely and ambrosial curls along her immortal head, and dressed in an ambrosial robe that Athena had made. Remember the Athena's a seamstress? That Athena had made her carefully, smooth, and with many figures upon it, and pinned it across her breast with a golden brooch, and circled her waist about with a zone, this is a belt, that floated 100 tassels, and in the lobes of her carefully pierced ears, she put rings with triple drops in mulberry clusters, radiant with beauty. And, lovely among goddesses, she veiled her head downward with a sweet fresh veil that glimmered pale like the sunlight, line 185. Underneath her shining feet, she bound on the fair sandals. Now, when she had clothed her body in all this loveliness, she went out from the chamber and called aside Aphrodite to come away from the rest of the gods. Aphrodite! And spoke a word to her. Line 190. Would you do something for me, dear child, if I were to ask you? Or would you refuse it? Are you forever angered against me because I defend the Danaans while you help the Trojans? Then the daughter of Zeus, Aphrodite, answered her, Hera, honored goddess, daughter to mighty Cronos, speak forth whatever is in your mind. My heart is urgent to do it if I can, and if it is a thing that can be accomplished. Then, with false lying purpose, the lady Hera answered her, Now Hera replies to Aphrodite, and she's lying. Give me loveliness and desirability, graces with which you overwhelm mortal men and all the immortals, since I go now to the ends of the generous earth on a visit to Oceanus, where the gods have risen, and Tethys, our mother, who brought me up kindly in their own house and cared for me, and took me from Rhea at the time when Zeus of the wide brows drove Cronos under the earth and the barren water. So what is Hera telling Aphrodite in her lie? Well, to begin with, as far as we know, the gods have not risen from the sea, according to any myth genealogy that we have, but that's what Homer tells us, whence the gods have risen. This is Oceanus, line 201. So she says, I'm going far away. And remember, Oceanus is at the far end of Homer's world. And so Hera is lying to Aphrodite, saying she's going as far away as possible. Line 205. I shall go to visit these, and resolve their division of discord, since now for a long time they've stayed apart from each other and from the bed of love, since rancor has entered their feelings. Could I win over with persuasion the dear heart within them, and bring them back to their bed to be merged in love with each other, I shall be forever called honored by them and beloved. So she's trying to stop a divorce among the gods. Line 210. Then in turn, Aphrodite, the laughing, answered her, I cannot, and I must not deny this thing that you ask for, you who lie in the arms of Zeus, since he is our greatest. She spoke, and from her breasts unbound the elaborate pattern-pierced zone, this is a belt, her magic belt, and on it are figured all beguilements, and loveliness is figured upon it, so it has a lot of embroidery, and passion of sex is there, and the whispered endearment that steals the heart away, even from the thoughtful. So Hera has used a lie to borrow Aphrodite's magic girdle, magic belt, or zone, as this translation is calling it. She put this in Hera's hands, and called her by name, and spoke to her, Take this zone, this is her belt, her Aphrodite's magic girdle, and hide it away in the fold of your bosom. Line 220, It is elaborate, all things are figured therein, so it's richly embroidered. And I think whatever is your heart's desire shall not go unaccomplished. So she spoke, and the ox-eyed Lady Hera smiled on her, and smiling hid the zone away in the fold of her bosom. So Aphrodite went back into the house, Zeus's daughter, while Hera in a flash of speed left the horn of Olympus, and crossed over Pyria and Emathia the lovely, and overswept the snowy hills of the Thracian riders and their uttermost pinnacles, nor touched the ground with her feet. Then from Athos she crossed over the heaving main sea, and came to Lemnos, line 230, and to the city of godlike Thoas. There she encountered Sleep, the brother of death. She clung fast to his hand and spoke a word and called him by name. Sleep, lord over all mortal men and all gods, if ever before now you listened to word of mine, so now also do as I ask, and all my days I shall know gratitude. Put to sleep the shining eyes of Zeus under his brows. As soon as I've lain beside him in love, I will give you gifts, a lovely throne, imperishable forever, of gold. My own son, he of the strong arms Hephaestus, shall make it with careful skill, and make for your feet a footstool on which you can rest your shining feet when you take your pleasure. So Hera here is bribing Sleep. Then Sleep, the still and soft, spoke to her in answer, Hera, honored goddess and daughter of mighty Cronos, to other one of the gods whose race is immortal, I would like to put to sleep even the stream of that river Oceanus, whence is risen the seed of all the immortals. But I would not come too close to Zeus, the son of Cronos, nor put him to sleep, unless he himself were to tell me. Before now, it was a favor to you that taught me wisdom. On the day Heracles, the high-hearted son of Zeus, was sailing from Ilion, when he had utterly sacked the city of the Trojans, that time I laid to sleep the brain of Zeus of the Aegis and drifted upon him, still and soft. But your mind was devising evil, and you raised along the sea the blasts of the racking winds, and on these swept him away to Cos, of the strong-founded, with all his friends lost. But Zeus awakened in anger, and beat the gods up and down his house, looking beyond all others for me, and would have sunk me out of sight in the sea from the bright sky, had not Night, who has power over gods and men, rescued me. So Hera has come to ask Night to put her husband to sleep, as soon as she romances him, and Sleek is not willing to do this. He learned his lesson the last time he helped Hera. Line 260. I reached her in my flight, and Zeus let be, though he was angry and awe of doing anything to swift Night's displeasure. Now you ask me to do this other impossible thing for you. But then in turn, the lady, ox-eyed Hera, answered him, Sleep, why do you ponder this in your heart and hesitate? Or do you think that Zeus of the wide brows, aiding the Trojans, will be angry as he was angry for his son Heracles? Come now, do it, and I'll give you one of the younger Graces for you to marry, and she shall be called your lady, Pasithea, since all your days you've loved her forever. Aha, one of the Graces, so now she's promising him a wife, somewhere for him to marry and be his lady. Line 270. So she spoke, and Sleep was pleased, and spoke to her in answer, Come then, swear it to me on the Styx, ineluctable water. With one hand take hold of the prospering earth, and with the other take hold of the shining salt sea, so that all the undergods who gather about Kronos may be witnesses to us. Okay, this oath by the Styx, of course, is the mightiest for the gods. Line 275. Swear that you will give me one of the younger Graces, Pasithea, the one whom all my days I have longed for. He spoke, nor failed to persuade the goddess Hera of the white arms, and she swore as he commanded, and called by their names on all those gods who live beneath the pit, and who are called Titans. Line 280. Then, when she had sworn this, and made her oath a complete thing, the two went away from Lemnos and the city of Imbrus, and mantled themselves in mist, and made their way very lightly till they came to Ida with all her springs, the mother of wild beasts, of Lectum, where first they left the water and went on over dry land, and with their feet the top of the forest was shaken. Line 285. There Sleep stayed, before the eyes of Zeus could light on him, and went up aloft a towering pine tree, the one that grew tallest at that time on Ida, and broke through the close air to the ether. This would be we'd call this the stratosphere, it's the higher sky, and so this is where Sleep is going to hide, up in the ether. In this he sat, covered over and hidden by the pine branches, in the likeness of a singing bird, whom in the mountains the immortal gods call Chalcis, but men call him Camindus. But Hera, light-footed, made her way to the peak of Gargarus on towering Ida, and Zeus, who gathers the clouds, saw her, and when he saw her, desire was a mist about his close heart, as much as on that time they first went to bed together and lay in love, and their dear parents knew nothing of it. So Zeus wasn't exactly a very nice suitor. He stood before her and called her by name and spoke to her, Hera, what is your desire that you come down here from Olympus? And your horses are not here, nor your chariot which you would ride in. Line 300. Then, with false lying purpose, the lady Hera answered him, I am going to the ends of the generous earth on a visit to Oceanus, whence the gods have risen, and Tethys, our mother, who brought me up kindly in their own house and cared for me. I shall go to visit these and resolve their division of discord. So she's going to try to prevent divorce or something back home. Since now for a long time they've stayed apart from each other and from the bed of love, since rancor has entered their feelings. In the foothills by Ida of the waters are standing my horses, who will carry me over hard land and water. Only now I've come down here from Olympus for your sake, so you will not be angry with me afterwards if I've gone silently to the house of deep-running Oceanus. And so Hera tells Zeus, I just came to tell you goodbye, so you won't be angry. Then in turn, Zeus, who gathers the clouds, answered her, Hera, there will be a time afterwards when you can go there as well. But now let us go to bed and turn to lovemaking. Line 315. For never before has love for any goddess or woman so melted about the heart inside me, broken it to submission, as now, and not that time. All right, so Zeus, the magic girdle is working. In fact, it's working so well, we now see Zeus for himself. It was line 315. For never before has love for any goddess or woman so melted about the heart inside me, broken it to submission as now. Never ever before did I ever have my heart just melt inside me, broken to submission like now. In fact, now he makes some comparisons. Line 317. Not that time when I loved the wife of Ixion, who bore me Perithous, equal of the gods in council, and nor when I loved Acrisius' daughter, sweet-stepping Danae, who bore Perseus to me, preeminent among all men, nor when I loved the daughter of far-renowned Phoenix, Europa, who bore Minos to me, and Rhadamanthus the godlike, nor when I loved Semele, or Alcmene in Thebe, when Alcmene bore me a son, Heracles the strong-hearted, while Semele's son was Dionysus, the pleasure of mortals, not when I loved the Queen Demeter of the lovely tresses, not when it was glorious Leto, nor yourself so much as now I love you, and the sweet passion has taken hold of me. So Zeus, we just got a list of all of Zeus's girlfriends, and he says, I never had my heart broken or softened this way, not with any of these other occasions. Then with false lying purpose, the lady Hera answered him, most honored son of Cronos, what sort of thing have you spoken? If now your great desire is to lie in love together here on the peaks of Ida, everything can be seen. Then what would happen if some one of the gods everlasting saw us sleeping and went and told all the other immortals of it? I would not simply rise out of bed and go back again into your house, and such a thing would be shameful. No, if this is your heart's desire, if this is your wish, then there's my chamber, which my beloved son Hephaestus has built for me, and closed the leaves in the doorpost snugly. We can go back there and lie down, since bed is your pleasure. Line 340. Then in turn Zeus, who gathers the clouds, answered her, Hera, do not fear that any mortal or any god will see. So close shall be the golden cloud that I gather about us. Not even Helios can look at us through it. So he's going to cover them with a thick cloud, although beyond all others his light has the sharpest vision, line 345, which means the sun can't even get through it. So speaking, the son of Cronos caught his wife in his arms. There underneath them the divine earth broke into young fresh grass and into dewy clover, crocus and hyacinth, so thick and soft it held the hard ground deep away from them. There they lay down together and drew about them a golden wonderful cloud, and from it the glimmering dew descended. So the father slept unshaken on the peak of Gargaron with his wife in his arms when sleep and passion had stilled him. But gently sleep went on the run to the ships of the Achaeans with a message to tell him who circles the earth and shakes it, Poseidon. So sleep is off to tell a message, tell him that Zeus is asleep, and stood close to him and addressed him in winged words. So this is sleep speaking to Poseidon. Poseidon, now with all your heart defend the Danaans and give them glory, though only for a little, while Zeus still sleeps, since I have mantled a soft slumber about him, and Hera beguiled him into sleeping in love beside her. Line 360. He spoke so, and went away among the famed races of men, and stirred Poseidon even more to defend the Danaans. He sprang among their foremost, and urged them on in his great voice, Argives, now once more we must give the best of it to Hector, Priam's son, so he may take our ships and win glory from them. Line 365. Such is his thought, and such is his prayer, because now Achilles, in the anger of his heart, stays still among the hollow ships, but there will not be too much longing for him if the others of us can stir ourselves up to stand by each other. Come then, do as I say. Let's all be won over. Let us take those shields, which are best in all the army and biggest, and put them on, and cover our heads in the complete shining of helmets, and take in our hands our spears that are longest, and go. I myself will lead the way, and I think that no longer Hector, Priam's son, can stand up to us for all his fury. Let the stubborn man in battle, who wears a small shield on his shoulder, give it to a worse man, and put on a shield that is bigger. So he spoke, and they listened hard to him and obeyed him. The kings in person marshaled these men, although they were wounded. Tydeus' son, Diomedes, line 380, and Odysseus and Atreus' son, Agamemnon. They went among all and made them exchange their armor of battle, and the good fighter put on the good armor, and each gave the worse gear to the worse. Then, when in the shining bronze they had shrouded their bodies, they went forward, and Poseidon, the shaker of the earth, led them, holding in his heavy hand, line 385, the stark sword with the thin edge glittering, as glitters the thunder flash none may close with by right in sorrowful division, but fear holds all men back. On the other side, glorious Hector ordered the Trojans, and now Poseidon of the dark hair and glorious Hector strained to its deadliest the division of battle, the one bringing power to the Trojans and the god to the Argives. The breaking of the sea washed up to the ships and the shelters of the Argives. The two sides closed together with a great war cry. Not such is the roaring against dry land of the sea's turf. What was it like? As it rolls in from the open under the hard blast of the north wind. Not such is the bellowing of fire and its blazing in the deep places of the hills when it rains inflaming the forest. Nor such again the crying voice of the wind in the deep-haired oaks when it roars highest in its fury against them. Not so loud as now the noise of Achaeans and Trojans in voice of terror rose as they drove against one another. First, glorious Hector made a cast with his spear at Aias, since he had turned straight against him, nor missed with his throw, but struck. There, where over the chest were crossed the two straps, one for the sword with the silver nails, and one for the great shield, line 405, these guarded the tenderness of his skin. And so you can imagine Aias with two leather straps going across his chest like an X. One's for his sword, and one is for his shield. And these guarded the tenderness of his skin, and it hit that. And Hector, in anger because his weapon had been loosed from his hand in a vain cast, to avoid death, shrank into the host of his own companions, because now he doesn't have a spear. But as he drew away, huge Telamonian Aias caught up a rock. There were many holding stones for the fast ships, like an anchor. 410. Rolled among the feet of the fighters. He caught up one of these and hit him in the chest, next the throat over his shield rim, and spun him around like a top with the stroke, so that he staggered in a circle, as a great oak goes down, root-torn under Zeus's father's stroke, and a horrible smell of sulfur arises from it, just like when a thunderbolt hits a tree and you smell the sulfur and it falls, and there's no courage left in a man who stands by and looks on, for the thunderstroke of great Zeus is a hard thing. So Hector, in all his strength, dropped suddenly in the dust, let fall the spear from his hand, and his shield was beaten upon him, and the helm and his armor elaborate with bronze clashed over him. Line 420. Screaming aloud, the sons of the Achaeans ran forward and hoped to drag him away, and threw their volleying javelins against him. Yet no man could stab or cast at the shepherd of the people. Sooner the Trojans' bravest gathered about him, Aeneas and Polydamas and brilliant Agenor. Line 425. Sarpedon, lord of the Lycaeans, and Glaucus the blameless. And of the rest no man was heedless of him, but rather sloped the strong circles of their shields over him, while his companions caught him in their arms, out of the fighting, and reached his fast-footed horses, where they stood to the rear of the fighting, and the battle holding their charioteer in the elaborate chariot, and these carried him, groaning heavily, back toward the city. So Hector's men are taking him back to the city. But when they came to the crossing place of the fair-running river of whirling Xanthus, whose father was Zeus the immortal, line 435, they moved him from behind his horses to the ground, and splashed water over him. He got his wind again, and his eyes cleared, and he got up to lean on one knee and vomit a dark clot of blood, then lay back on the ground again, while over both eyes dark night misted. His strength was still broken by the stone's stroke, so he passed out again. Line 440, but the Argives, when they saw Hector withdrawing from them, so the Greeks, when they saw the Trojan Hector leaving, remembered once again their warcraft and turned on the Trojans. These far before them, all swift Aias, son of Oileus, made an outrush. Oh, there far before them all. There far before them all, swift Aias, son of Oileus, made an outrush and stabbed with the sharp spear Satnius, Enops' son, whom the perfect Naiad nymph had borne once to Enops, line 445, as he tended his herds by Santinius's river. The spear-famed son of Oileus, coming close to this man, stabbed him in the flank so that he knocked him backward, and over him Trojans and Danaans closed together in strong encounter. Polydamas of the shaken spear came up to stand by him, Panthous's son, and struck in the right shoulder Prothaonor, son of Rilichos, and the powerful spear was driven through the shoulder, and he, dropping in the dust, clawed the ground in his fingers. Polydamas now is going to vaunt over Prothaonor. Polydamas vaunted terribly over him, calling in a great voice, I think this javelin, leaping from the heavy hand of Panthous's high-hearted son, was not thrown away in a vain cast. Rather, some Argive caught it in his skin. I think he's got it for a stick to lean on as he trudges down into death's house. He spoke, and sorrow came over the Argives at his vaunting. And beyond others he stirred the anger in wise Telamonian Aias, for the man had fallen closest to him, and at once he made a cast with the shining spear at returning Polydamas. But Polydamas himself avoided the dark death with a quick spring to one side, and Archilochus, son of Antenor, caught the spear, since the immortal gods had doomed his destruction. He hit him at the joining place of head and neck, line 465, at the last vertebrae, and cut through both of the tendons, so that the man's head and mouth and nose hit the ground far sooner than did the front of his legs and knees as he fell. And Aias spoke aloud in answer to unfaulted Polydamas. Line 470. Think over this, Polydamas, and answer me truly. Is not this man's death against Prothoenor's a worthwhile exchange? I think he is no mean man, nor born of mean fathers, but is some brother of Antenor, breaker of horses, or his son, since he is close in battle, in blood, by the look of him. So he thinks he's somebody famous because he looks similar to him. So Polydamas just vaunted over poor Prothoenor in line 453 to 457. And so Aias is going to vaunt over Polydamas when he kills him. Line 475. He spoke, knowing well what he said, and sorrow fastened on the Trojans. There Acamas, bestriding his brother, stabbed the Boeotian Promachus with the spear as he tried to drag off the body. Acamas vaunted terribly over him, calling in a great voice, "You Argives, Greeks, arrow fighters," that's a slam, "insatiate of menace, I think we shall not be the only ones to be given hard work and sorrow, but you too must sometimes die as this man did. Think how Promachus sleeps among you, beaten down under my spear, so that punishment for my brother may not go long unpaid. Therefore a man prays he will leave behind him one close to him in his halls to avenge his downfall in battle." Line 485. And of course this is an important concept in the Homeric age, is vengeance. He spoke, and sorrow came over the Argives at his vaunting, line 486. And beyond others he stirred the anger in wise Peneleos. He charged Acamas, who would not stand up against the onset of Lord Peneleos. He then stabbed with the spear Ilioneus, the son of Phorbas, the rich in sheep flocks, whom beyond all men of the Trojans Hermes loved, the god Hermes, and gave him possessions. Ilioneus was the only child his mother had borne him. This man Peneleos caught underneath the brow at the bases of the eye and pushed the eyeball out, and the spear went clean through the eye socket and tendon of the neck, so that he went down backward, reaching out both hands. But Peneleos, drawing his short sword, hewed at the neck in the middle, and so dashed downward the head, with helm upon it, while still on the point of the big spear, the eyeball stuck. He, lifting it high, like the head of a poppy, displayed it to the Trojans, and spoke vaunting over it. And so here, who's the soldier? He stabbed, he spoke, and he came over them, Acamas. He's vaunting, he has his sword in his hand, line 500, with an eyeball on the sword, like the head of a poppy. "Trojans, tell haughty Ilioneus's beloved father and mother from me," the man whose eyeball he has, "that they can weep for him in their halls, since neither shall the wife of Promachus, Algenor's son, take pride of delight in her dear lord's coming on that day when we sons of the Achaeans come home from Troy in our vessels." Line 505. So he spoke, and the shivers came over the limbs of all of them, and each man looked about him for a way to escape the sheer death. "Tell me now, you muses," and this is Homer breaking into the story to appeal to the muses again, and of course this draws our attention to what follows. "Tell me now, you muses, who have your homes on Olympus, who was first of the Achaeans to win the bloody despoilment of men when the glorious shaker of the earth bent the way of battle?" When Poseidon bent the way of battle, line 510. "First, Telamonian Aias cut down Hyrtius, he who was son to Gyrtius and lord over the strong-hearted Mycians. Antilochus slaughtered Phalces and Myrmeros. Mores and Hippotion were killed by Meriones. Teucrus cut down Periphetes and Prothoon. Next, the son of Atreus, Menelaus, stabbed Hyperenor, shepherd of the people, in the flank, So the bronze head let gush out the entrails through the torn side, so his guts came out. His life came out through the wound of the spear stab, in beating haste, and a mist of darkness closed over both eyes. But Aias, the fast-footed son of Oileus, line 520, caught and killed most, since there was none like him in the speed of his feet, to go after men who ran, once Zeus had driven the terror upon them. And that is the end of book 14.